Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the 2007 Farm Bill. Back at the end of January, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Johanns, unveiled the USDA's Farm Bill proposals for this year. Now, this is an exercise that happens every 5 years. The current bill will expire this year, and a lot of people would say that writing new legislation, updating the existing legislation, is certainly one of the most important things that the Congress will do this year. This is something that, not surprisingly, matters a lot to farmers and people who are in agribusiness, but arguably it should matter to just about everyone because not only does the Farm Bill provide money for commodity payments, for example, to farmers, but it also provides money for food stamps and for school lunch programs and for conservation programs and for renewable energy. So you certainly can argue that in some sense, it not only has a profound impact on farming and food production, but ultimately on everybody because we all eat. In this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about what's going on here with the rewrite of the Farm Bill, what the bill does, what's in it, why it's important to farmers, why it should be important to everyone, and perhaps look at the question this time around. Will we something that's really different here now in 2007 from the last time we did this, which would have been 2002? And we have as our guest someone who has been working in the areas of development, agricultural policy for a long time, and who has also been here with us before on the show, Robert Thompson. He holds the Gardner Chair in Agricultural Policy here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. Before that, he was at the World Bank, where he served as its Director of Rural Development. Before that, he served as president and CEO of Winrock International Institute for Agricultural Development. This was a not-for-profit which worked on projects in many countries around the world to reduce poverty and hunger by increasing agricultural productivity and rural employment, while at the same time trying to keep in mind the importance of the environment. Before that, he was the Dean of Agriculture at Purdue, and before that, he worked as Assistant Secretary for Economics at the USDA, and also was Senior Staff Economist for Food and Agriculture on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. And we're pleased to have him here on the program. Questions are certainly welcome. People who are listening are invited to call. We ask only that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep things moving along here and get in as many callers as possible. But callers are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
To ask just what is obviously a very big question just to start off with, what's the Farm Bill for? What's the purpose of it?
Well, the first Farm Bill was passed in 1933 in the depths of the Depression when farm family incomes were running about 40% of the already low incomes of members of the rest of society, and there was a desperate need to do something to help bail out farmers, both keep them from going bankrupt, but also to lift them out of poverty. So the original intent was to reduce the income gap between farmers who suffered much lower incomes than people in the rest of the United States. Over time, many more functions have been added, a lot of conservation, investments in agricultural research, federal money that supports agriculture research and extension here in the Midwest is authorized in the farm bills. Food stamps came along. As the number of farmers shrank over time, it was necessary to gain a greater urban constituency for farm bills. And so the food stamps were put into the farm bill, and today they run substantially higher total expenditures than farm commodity programs. And, of course, all the food safety, quality control, and today with the concerns about bioterrorism, that whole set of issues are addressed as well in the authorizing legislation in the farm bill.
Yeah. So just to underline one point, I think it's good for people to keep in mind that while we are talking about something that we talk about it as some sort of unitary entity, we talk about the Farm Bill, it has all of these various parts, and that indeed it is altogether a big chunk of money. I think the administration is talking about almost $88 billion, but that about half of that That's not payments to farmers. That's not things that we think of as farm programs. Almost half of that is the other things. That's food stamps, it's school lunches, it's those sorts of things. So while most of the attention is on commodities support payments, for example, a lot of money does go into these other areas and not directly to farm.
In fact, the farm commodity programs only run about $20 billion out of that total. Mm-hmm. So it's closer to 20-25% of the total today. Actually, the biggest part of the USDA in terms of employment is the U.S. Forest Service and the Soil Conservation Service.
So now we're talking about this now because this is the year in which the rewrite will happen. Officially, the administration's made recommendations. The bill runs out, so we have to have a new one. But within agriculture, and if you look at all the various interest groups, people that are interested in the environment, in food policy, the people that represent various kinds of producers, the people who grow corn and cotton, and the dairy farmers, and the so-called specialty crops, people have been talking about this now for quite some time, for probably at least a couple of years, and making recommendations. Everybody had their own set of recommendations for the rewrite of the bill. And I think before we got going, you said that, in fact, that more different people, more groups have weighed in on this farm bill rewrite than perhaps has ever been the case before.
More groups with a greater diversity of interest, all the way from the churches, as you say, to the whole range of the business community. The petroleum industry is interested because of what incentives might be there for ethanol production. So it's an unbelievably diverse set of voices that are weighing in. Now, at the end of the day, the agricultural organizations usually hold greatest sway in what comes out of the agriculture committees. And certainly in the United States Senate, every senator has enough farmers in his or her state that they have to be concerned about the farm bill and farmer well-being. The House of Representatives, though, which has become such an urban-dominated body, is a whole different can of beans. Mm-hmm. There probably aren't 35 out of the 435 members of the House of Representatives that have enough farmers in their district to worry about in their next reelection campaign. Mm-hmm. So as a result, you've got to have plenty of things in that farm bill that are going to appeal to that broader American interest, and that's food stamps, it's energy independence, it's environmental and conservation concerns, it's et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that some of these groups would like to believe that it is time for us to start thinking really very differently about how we approach these things. And then I'm sure that there were also people who would say basically, well, we think the way we've been doing things now is just fine, and we might want to make a couple of small changes, but they're not advocating revolutionary change. When you look at the recommendations that the Bush administration has made, these things that the secretary now put on the table now all these months ago, is that very different? Is the administration talking about doing things that are dramatically different from the 2002?
Actually, the administration listened to the full range of interest groups that came to testify when the Secretary of Agriculture had his listening sessions around the country. And I think their proposal was incredibly politically astute in the way they addressed it. Most farm organizations up until the summer of 2006 were advocating just extend the 2002 Farm Bill forward. We like it real well. It's serving as an adequate safety net in years when prices or yields drop. So let's just keep it as it is. But then the price of corn and other commodities shot through the ceiling last summer. And all of a sudden, the National Corn Growers Association looked at this and said, hey, with these high prices of corn, we're not going to get anything out of this farm bill if we extend it 5 years into the future. Then the price of soybeans rose, the price of wheat rose. And so you started seeing more and more groups say, maybe we should rethink this, that we need a safety net in years if prices or yields drop catastrophically. But except for cotton, there was no commodity that thought they were going to get much out of that farm bill. So this sort of set the stage for the administration to make some more fundamental proposals than they might otherwise have made. They also listened to the entire range of environmental concerns, to the renewable energy concerns. And in the end, and also they paid a lot of attention to the WTO trade negotiations, because Brazil took the United States to the WTO, which functions as the Supreme Court of International Trade, alleging that our cotton program was stimulating more production of cotton, that when pushed out into the world market, depressed world market prices, which are the prices from which Brazilian farmers get the entire income, and said, hey, this is dirty pool. U.S. has got to change. And the U.S. lost the case. We have not yet fully made those changes. They need to be addressed in this farm bill. But why it's relevant to us in the Midwest is the same provisions of the cotton program that were found to be illegal in the relative to international trade law are the same basic structure of our corn and soybean and wheat programs. So the USDA, first in addressing that concern from the WTO, basically proposed reducing the loan rate or the support price for all of the grains and oilseeds and cotton down to 85% of a five-year moving average. In other words, it would continue to function as a safety net, but in normal years, it wouldn't be stimulating larger production because it would be there as a safety net below what you expect the market clearing price would be. On the other hand, for commodities which do not anticipate getting any benefits from the current programs if they're extended forward, like the grains and oil seeds, USDA proposed an opt-out in which a farmer would get a stepped-up flat rate of payment per acre of land each year. This is basically the approach the European Union has taken. They've gotten out of the business of supporting prices of commodities and instead make an annual per acre payment that goes out to farmers, and so it has no distortionary effect on what the farmer produces. And then the third thing that the USDA proposed was responsive to the corn growers and to a number of the conservation groups under the leadership of the American Farmland Trust, who've been proposing a revenue insurance program as opposed to a price or yield or crop insurance program. In other words, the safety net that farmers need really relates to their earning potential, and it may be dashed by low commodity prices or bad crop year in terms of bad weather conditions, drought. So their proposal would basically have the USDA stand ready to backfill if the total revenue of the farm, not for specific commodity, but the total farm, were to drop below a certain level, because farming is an inherently risky business. So instead of having a price trigger for counter-cyclical payments, USDA proposed a revenue trigger.
Well, let me make sure I understand it, that this and ask a couple of questions. I think, well, first of all, I think one of the observations that people make is that one of the things we could say about American agriculture, say in the era after World War II, is that it has become magnificently productive. The problem with that can be is that if you're really, really productive, you're producing a lot of crop, the supply goes way up. Maybe the supply even exceeds demand, and so that drives down the price. And the problem is that that farmers looked at that and said, boy, you know, with the price this low, the only way that I can continue to make at least a reasonable profit is to produce more. Instead of doing what you might think would be the thing to do is say, well, what we need to do is cut back on the supply so then the price will come up. Farmers have said, well, geez, if we're going to survive, we're just going to have to increase our yields and produce more. And that somehow the previous programs that the government had to support the price actually fed into that. So it just made it worse and worse and worse. Now is what they're proposing to do fundamentally going to change that?
Well, of course, the one factor that has played into the scenario you characterize, and you're absolutely right, agricultural output in the United States grew by a factor of 2.6 times between World War II and the turn of the century, and actually used less inputs in the year 2000 than we did at the end of World War II. So the productivity growth was phenomenal, much faster than in the rest of the American economy. But what was going on over that period was exports. We export the product of one out of every 3 acres of land, generating about 25% of our total sales revenue in American agriculture from the export market. So in other words, every farmer in the United States is feeding something like 150 people here and abroad. So it is the greatest productivity success story in agriculture that's ever occurred in the world. Now, what's come out in recent years, though, is ethanol, that we're going to use an immense amount of our corn production in ethanol. In fact, ethanol production took more corn last year than exports. And the 20% of our corn crop that we have been exporting over the years has represented 60%. That's 60% of the corn that moves through world trade. So this is a huge shift as we start to pull corn out of the market to make ethanol instead of exporting it, and then expanding our corn acreage, pulling land out of soybeans, out of cotton, out of rice, out of wheat, into corn to satisfy this rapidly growing demand for ethanol. And of course, that's what's given us the high prices, where corn price doubled last year, and most other commodity prices followed it up. And so, as a result, our commodity programs don't appear to be needed in the sense of providing any support in the market for at least the grains and oilseeds for the foreseeable future, with this rapid growth in the ethanol industry. So that has really changed the terms of the game. Mm-hmm. We got the productivity. We'll still be exporting, not as much as before. We'll still be exporting, and we'll be making a lot of ethanol and reducing our dependence on imported petroleum.
Yeah. Let me ask another question, because as we made the point back at the beginning that, first of all, that the Farm Bill, there are many different programs and facets to it, and that while most of the attention, perhaps the controversial thing, has to do with payments to farmers, that's really only a small – that's what I think out of the $88 billion we're talking about, that's only something like 20%.
20 billion.
Of 20 billion of that 88 billion. But having said that, that's the thing that seems to get a lot of attention. And there has been a lot of criticism aimed at the payments to farmers, that – most of the money goes to a small percentage of farmers, that while we say what we're trying to do is support the family farm, that actually the farmers, a lot of the farms that are getting these big payments are very large farms. Some of the payments go to corporations. Some of the payments go to absentee landlords. So they're not even people who are farm. They own the land, but they don't farm the land. And I think a lot of people had said, you know, we got a problem with not so much the idea that we are supporting the price and trying to help farmers, but who it is that's getting most of the money. Now, if we're talking about changing that system somewhat, and if we're saying that at least for the foreseeable future, we don't need to support the prices of some of these basic commodities because they're doing just fine, is it still going to be, though, we are still going to be making some kind of payments to farmers, and this are there still going to be people who say, we've got a problem with who it is that's getting whatever kind of payment we're still making. Is that still going to be an issue?
Well, the equity issues have really come to the fore. And even the Secretary of Agriculture, in virtually every speech over the last 18 months, has raised the equity question. There are a couple of things. Five commodities, or the producers of five commodities, get 93%. More than 60% of American agriculture gets no support. The fruit and vegetables don't get support, and animal agriculture, except for dairy, doesn't get support. So you're basically talking about grains, oilseeds, cotton, and dairy, and sugar that get the government support. So there's the inequity associated with, well, what's so special about those commodities? What about the other 60% that parenthetically seems to be just as profitable or more so than the part of agriculture that's getting the government support? And then, as you pointed out, the payments tend to be concentrated in the hands of the largest producers and the largest farmland owners. The way our programs have been designed in the past is the payments have been linked to the volume of production of specific commodities, so whoever grows the most gets the most benefit. And because this increases the return per acre of land, even landowners who with cash rents are then able to raise the rent. And so cash rents have been going up as the farm program payments have gone up. So you have concentration of the payments in the hands of the largest producers and ultimately landowners. And the income problem in American agriculture is really in the medium-sized full-time family farm. The smallest farms, they're principally rural residence farms. They earn most of their income from non-farm employment. They like to live in the country. They don't have an income problem. And certainly commercial-scale agriculture doesn't have an income problem. But the small to medium-sized full-time family farm, they don't grow enough, or they don't grow the right commodities to get much benefit from the government programs. And so if that's the problem we're worried about, the programs really need to be redesigned to reach the target audience.
We have a caller here and would welcome others. Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, Robert Thompson. He holds the Gardner Chair in Agricultural Policy at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He has also been an official at the World Bank. He served as its Director of Rural Development. He served as President and CEO of Winrock International Institute for Agricultural Development. This is a not-for-profit that carried out projects in many countries around the world to increase egg productivity. Before that, he was Dean of Agriculture at Purdue, and then before that also was Assistant Secretary for Economics at USDA and Senior Staff Economist for Food and Agriculture on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and we do have a caller. Line number one. Hello, here in Urbana, I think. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you for doing this important program. I have, lots of thoughts on this, but I'll try and limit myself. First, I heard a program last night on WILL about the use of methane for energy, because methane releases a lot of bad gases into the atmosphere, and so it's better if we can use that rather than just having it go up into the atmosphere. And I was wondering if you could comment on what the Farm Bill might have to do with things like that, first of all, and then I'll let you answer that and then ask a couple other things.
Okay.
Yes. Livestock and poultry produce a lot of manure, and as that manure decomposes, it releases methane. What is being done in some countries, more in Europe, but there are a few experiments here in the U.S., is you effectively put a tent over the a canvas tent over the vessel in which the manure is put after it's cleaned out of the stable. And as the methane is produced, it's pulled off out from under that tent and is burned as fuel. And there are farms which are 100% self-sufficient in their energy supply as a result of that. In the Farm Bill, in the whole renewable energy area, there's quite a bit of money for research on alternative energy sources. There's been money available to help incentivize building windmills on farms. I don't know the specifics of what they have proposed on the methane, but I know that there's a strong commitment to both improving the environment, but also reduce our energy dependence at the same time. So good question.
And since you brought up wind farming, a comment that you made a couple minutes ago made me think about that, because I've always heard of wind farming as being a way that to help farmers supplement their income. But then you said that it's been proposed that farmers, if they didn't reach a certain level of income, then they would be subsidized above that, regardless of what they were growing. Would this have an impact on farmers deciding to go into wind farming or not? Would they maybe decide, well, if I'm going to get money from the government anyway, then I don't need to put the effort into finding someone who wants to put wind turbines on my land?
No, I think your last point is what's relevant. Are the windmills going to become an impediment to efficient cultivation of the farm? I think that is one of the overriding concerns of producers, regardless of what it is they're growing or whether or not they're producing anything that gets government support. No, the revenue insurance notion that that I mentioned before would basically be if there was a devastating drop in rainfall or in commodity prices that caused a huge drop in farm revenue below some trend or below some fraction of a trend. And normally people talk about if it drops below 70% of your normal income. So we're not talking about raising farmers' incomes above what the market can provide. It's just being there as a safety net in years of devastation because of bad climate or bad prices.
Okay, so it's something that farmers wouldn't expect to benefit from year to year. It would just be every few years.
No, that's right. It just okay. When, if and when there was a severe drop in their receipts, and I think most people acknowledge that farming is one of the riskiest businesses because of the volatility of both crop yields as well as prices. We here in the Corn Belt are blessed that we have such stable climatic conditions that rarely do we get a drought like we had a year or two ago. But you go down in the Texas Panhandle or up in the Dakotas, you have much higher variance of rainfall, and for them, insurance is a big deal.
Okay. And then I'll just ask one last question. So one of the things that's frustrating being surrounded by all this incredibly fertile farmland is having almost all of it dedicated to corn and soybeans, and going to the grocery store and seeing that the lettuce and the tomatoes and all the other produce that I buy comes from California or Latin America. And I was wondering if you could talk about what changes might be made in the farm bill to encourage growth of more crops that humans eat on a local level, and that also has environmental impacts because of not having to ship the food from far away, so that reduces our carbon emissions. And I'll listen to your answer to that off the air.
Right. Okay. There is quite a bit of incentive that's being provided now to farmers markets and developing that kind of system. And this is the great opportunity for small to medium-sized family farmers to produce specialty crops, to produce crops for local farmers markets, because the markup on those is substantially larger than you can ever get producing bulk commodities like corn or soybeans. And you're exactly right when you observe this wonderfully fertile soil we have. And in fact, there are only three places on the planet that have such fertile soil as we have right here in the heart of the Corn Belt with these deep black fertile soils. Here, the pump of Argentina, and in the Ukraine just north of the Black Sea. That's it. So we are blessed. But farmers choose to produce whatever they can make the most money on their land. And because our climatic conditions together with these soils make such wonderful corn and soybean producing lands and such huge productivity that most of our producers will grow corn or soybeans, and especially now with these huge prices that we have for corn and for soybeans that have resulted from the ethanol development. The issue of food miles, which you address in this latter question, though, is highly controversial. And in fact, if every region tries to be self-sufficient in everything, it actually usually ends up causing greater environmental damage because you end up trying to produce the wrong crops in the wrong places. So when I look at the food miles argument, I think there are usually strong arguments against it because of the environmental damage that will result from trying to be self-sufficient in everything in a locality.
Well, I hope that gets the questions of the call. We got a couple of others. Next, we'll go over to Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. I would like to point out with our farming techniques that have transpired over the last 200-some years, we have destroyed a very large forest that also helped the environment. And in the process of the farm bill, we added a thing called set-aside ground, if I'm right, that allowed farmers to be paid to keep some of this ground that controls erosion and may even help with global warming a little bit. We've put that there for farmers to use, but yet now with these high corn prices, they want to go back to wall-to-wall farming again, get rid of every square inch that could possibly be farmed. They want to farm, want to farm it. That seems like it's very counterproductive. And also, you said you were a member of the World Bank. They've been instrumental in destroying huge areas of forest and things that have turned into farm ground, ranch ground, whatever, also adding to the carbon problem that we have today. Would you like to address that, sir?
Yes. First, I would disagree with your very initial premise about the modern high-productivity agriculture destroying forests. And in fact, the opposite has occurred. Because of the 2.6-fold increase in productivity in the post-World War II period, that means that we're using actually less land today to produce 2.6 times as much output as we were. Just think, if we hadn't had those productivity increases, how much more forest would have been destroyed. So high-productivity agriculture is the only sustainable future to make the maximum benefit from the good, fertile, non-erodible soils of the planet so we can protect as much forest land as possible. So that's my first response. The conservation, there are two types of set-aside. Back in the 70s and into the 80s, because our productivity had risen so rapidly and we had high price supports, we were creating huge surpluses that were ending up in government inventories. And so Congress mandated that farmers set aside, leave idle, a certain percentage of their land each year, basically tying one arm of the American farmer behind his or her back to hold them back on their productivity so we didn't end up with so much surpluses in government hands. That was really counterproductive. It reduced the efficiency of American agriculture. So in the 1985 Farm Bill, the one that I worked on when I was in government in the mid-80s, that was when the long-term conservation reserve was created. And this was designed to identify the most highly erodible soils and retire them long-term, 10-year contracts. So the farmer got some assistance in planting trees or whatever was perennial was planted on that land, and then received an annual rental payment from the government to leave it idle so that we're not contributing to greater soil erosion. Also to encourage farmers to plant filler strips along streams to reduce the runoff into those streams. But those are the basic issues related to the set-aside that a lot of people fear now with the rapid growth in the ethanol production that we're going to pull a lot of land back out of the long-term conservation reserve, land that may be erodible and actually contribute to environmental problems as a result of that. So that's going to be watched very carefully. It's going to be a hot issue in this Farm Bill debate. But at least during the time that I was Director of Agriculture and Rural Development at the World Bank, we put a very high priority on working with farmers wherever in the world they had decent soils to maximize their productivity on that soil, exactly for the reason that you mentioned, to protect as much of the forested area as possible, because we do need those forests to convert carbon to basically take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
May I point out, sir, that the entire state of Ohio, essentially the entire state of Indiana, the entire state of Kentucky, most of the state of Tennessee were all covered with forest at one time. Take a drive across I-70 and you don't see a whole lot of forest anymore. That's what I'm pointing out, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. I don't know if you want to comment.
Well, you've got choice of people or feeding people or having trees. Obviously, as our population grew, we needed land as settlement moved westward. The forests were in the areas you described were cut, and the prairies of where we live here Illinois, Iowa, and all out through the Great Plains. The tall and short grass prairies also were plowed up and put into crops. I guess we have a choice there of whether we want people or prairie or as extensive prairie and forest land as we had at the time of our settlement.
Let me just go back for a second for one of the things that the previous caller raised, and this has to do with the what are called the specialty crops.
Yes.
That I guess there we're really talking about things like fruits and vegetables, for example. And you talked about the fact that the bulk of the payments to farmers has historically gone to people who produce a relatively small number of crops, and that's corn, wheat, soybeans, cotton,
rice, sugar,
and then sugar and dairy, and that people have made this argument that says, well, if not only if we want to support small and medium farmers, but we're talking here about we're encouraging people to eat more fruits and vegetables and have a healthier diet, well, let's do something for people that grow the fruits and vegetables. So in this proposal that the administration has put out now earlier in the year, they're putting more money into supporting the people who grow these things. Now, it's, I don't know, it's almost $5 billion. Now, I don't know, maybe that's a lot of money and maybe it's, my question is, well, is that very much money and where is that money going to go?
Okay. There is a significant commitment to trying to improve the American the quality of the American diet by introducing more fruits and vegetables into it in this Farm Bill proposal. First, there's an exclusion in the present Farm Bill that says if you're getting direct payments as a corn or soybean or wheat grower, you cannot grow fruits and vegetables on your land. So there's actually a prohibition against growing fruits and vegetables. The administration proposes getting rid of that, which I think makes eminent sense. But then the administration proposes $5 billion for research, product promotion, and purchases of fruits and vegetables for food distribution programs, like the school lunch program, mm-hmm. like distribution of foods to low-income people.
We have several callers here. We have about 10 minutes left. And let me again very quickly introduce our guest, Robert Thompson. He holds the Gardner Chair in Agricultural Policy at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. He was the Director of Rural Development at the World Bank from mid-98 until late 2002. Before that, he served as President, CEO of Winrock International Institute for Agricultural Development. This was a nonprofit organization working on a number of countries around the world to increase agricultural productivity and thus reduce poverty and hunger. From 1987 until 1993, he was Dean of Agriculture at Purdue University. And before that, he served as Assistant Secretary for Economics at USDA, that's between 85 and 87, and was also Senior Staff Economist for Food and Agriculture on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. That's from 83 to 85. And we're pleased to have him here. We're talking about the Farm Bill and farm legislation that gets its regular five-year update, rewrite, whatever you want to call it, this year. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Monticello is the next person here listening and calling. That's line number two. Hello.
Yes, I just sort of wondering, do you think the crop insurance programs will soon replace, direct supports or any of those other payments, buying commercial crop insurance, like revenue assurance and GRIP and all that? Do you think that'll replace all these other programs? Thank you, and I'll listen on the other end.
Okay, thanks.
There certainly are proposals out there, including the Corn Growers and the American Farmland Trust, that would move in that direction. They don't necessarily go as far as what I'm going to describe, but probably the most extreme would be to go to something like a pure revenue insurance program and take everything we've been spending for loan deficiency payments, countercyclical payments, disaster payments, and the subsidy to federal crop insurance, which is massive, and take the savings from all of those and put them into a new revenue insurance program, which might be like GRIP or might be like AGR or AGR Lite, those three options in the present crop insurance program, so that rather than insuring crop yields, you'd be insuring revenue of the farm. Do I think we're likely to go that far? Probably not in one farm bill. We rarely get that revolutionary a change from one farm bill to the next. I think we'll see some movement in the direction of revenue insurance, maybe like the administration's proposal. But what I described a couple of minutes ago, would be such a revolutionary change that would be I think Congress would like to see more of a trial run of the AGR, AGR Light, and GRIP before going whole hog in that direction.
All right. To next caller is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yeah. You know, we know that in terms of, you know, that water is going to be a big issue in the coming years. What about the in terms of water and ethanol and all that? I mean, it seems to we're going to increase the demand for water.
Okay, you're absolutely right. In fact, water will probably become a greater constraint on worldwide agriculture than land availability. Farmers worldwide use 70% of the fresh water. And with the rapid rate of urbanization that's going on in the world, cities are outbidding farmers for the available water. We even see farms in the Central Valley of California being bought up by Southern California cities, which strip off the water rights and then ship the water south to augment those cities' water supply. And as the American population continues to grow, there will become increasing competition with farmers. All the pumping that's done out of the Ogallala Aquifer out in from the Texas High Plains up through Kansas and Nebraska, that aquifer is receding. It's unsustainable that they'll be able to continue producing in the same manners they have been because the water's simply not going to be there. So we do need to be cautious as we add a big new demand, water demand, such as the ethanol industry, to make sure that where we do it, we have an abundant supply of water. And I think it should be incumbent upon the ethanol industry to be as efficient as possible in using that water, returning it to nature in as clean a manner as possible. And, of course, water is not used up. So the challenge is that use the water, return it to nature in a clean form so that it can be cycled several times within the same year. As long as we do water management adequately and efficiently in irrigation, I think we'll get along. But you're absolutely right that water will probably become the number one challenge of world agriculture in the future.
Okay, I just have a couple. I'll go off the air here. In terms of, it seems to me that when we don't have lots of diversity, the increase in pesticides and also in terms of fertilizing. And then the final one is that in terms of, does growing cotton make sense, in the U.S.? But I'll just let you comment on those two or whatever.
Okay, well, there's no question but what we use more irrigation water on cotton and probably on rice and certainly on alfalfa to feed to dairy cattle than we would if we did not have the present price support programs. Cotton, rice, and sugar are all crops that in which the humid tropics are more efficient producers than the U.S. And there are a number of people who question whether we should produce any sugar in the United States, that our current sugar program increases the domestic price of sugar from 2 to 6 times the world market price, depending on the year, and has made a contributor to driving our candy industry out of Chicago, for example. And certainly places in West Africa and in Brazil are probably more efficient producers of cotton than we are. Interestingly, with these high prices of corn this year, reportedly down in the Mississippi Delta in Mississippi, about 25% of the cotton land is shifting into corn. So farmers are responding to the market. And they also recognize that we lost the cotton case in the WTO and that there are changes going to have to be made which reduce the profitability of cotton production because it has been artificially profitable. So your point's right on.
All right. To Charleston, I believe. Yes. Line number three. Hello.
Yes. Two things. Can you or do you have an opinion on why the internal combustion engine, I think I know why there has been no meaningful alternative to that. And humans are supposedly alert. and then why there has been no addressing of overpopulation of for humans upon this earth. Thank you, and I'll listen up here.
Okay, well, I'm not an engineer, and I simply can't respond to the question about, I have no idea the answer to your question about why we haven't made further improvements on the internal combustion engine. On population control, I think you understate the progress that has been made in some places. Forced sterilization was tried in India, and that's certainly not morally acceptable from our standpoint. China adopted the one-child policy. It was quite successful in bringing the population growth rate of China down. And now they're stuck in the situation. Their population is aging so rapidly, they're probably going to get rid of that one-child policy. You can distribute as many condoms as you want around the world and promote birth control pills, but until you give girls education and improve the lot of women in the world, they don't tend to do a lot of good. Nothing brings down the rate of population growth faster than improved opportunities for women outside the household, as well as education of girls. And those countries that thwart the education of girls are basically committing themselves to much more rapid population growth than is probably desirable. Up until this point, we've been able to increase productivity at a fast enough rate so that we've been able to feed the world better than before, the world's larger population better than before, using less land than before. But the reality remains that with trying to increase our energy independence from agriculture as well, the world's farmers are going to really be challenged in the 21st century to satisfy the food and energy needs.
All right. We'll get one more caller here, someone in West Central Indiana on our toll-free line. Line 4, hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a concern about our overweight children in school. If we had or could afford the free lunch program for all children, so there would be no discrimination, and they'd have a balanced diet. What do you think about this?
Well, I think the school lunch program and actually the school breakfast programs have been wonderful innovations in the United States and have made significant contributions to improve nutrition of kids. I'm not sure that they, in and of themselves, will address the obesity problem as much as long as the schools have lots of candy vending machines and soda pop machines. There's no question but what this issue is going to be raised in the Farm Bill. There are even some people who say, well, maybe keeping the price of sugar high in the U.S. is not all bad because it may actually reduce the amount of candy people eat. I'm not sure I buy that. I think that we're a wealthy enough society and candy is tempting enough that kids are probably going to get it anyway as long as it's available. So I guess I would prefer getting those vending machines out of the schools so that at least while they're at school, with the school lunch program and in those places where there's a school breakfast program, that the kids get a good balanced diet and not an excess of calories.
Mm. I want to thank the caller. I want to thank all the callers. We're just about out of time here, maybe have about 2 minutes. Just can I ask you just to talk for about that long about a little more about how much money now we're putting into alternative energy. To this point, I suppose most of that has gone into corn, ethanol from corn. Now we're talking about putting more money into research on cellulosic ethanol, which I know some people think is promising, but that's a technology that has a long way to go. Are we putting significant amounts of money into continued research on that?
Well, the only commitment in the administration's Farm Bill proposal to more money for research and for pilot plants is in cellulosic. feedstocks. I think this is in response to strong lobbying that they're getting from the poultry industry, the swine industry, as well as animal agriculture more generally, because these high prices of corn and soybean meal that have resulted from the ethanol development to date are having a devastating impact on the profitability of the American animal agriculture, both poultry and livestock. And so they do not want any more incentives to expand ethanol from corn. And they'd like to see acceleration of getting alternatives so that more of the corn becomes available at lower prices to the livestock industry. The ethanol, the corn-based ethanol, has gotten massive support from the use mandates, the 52-cent a gallon import tariff on ethanol from the world market, the blender's credit, a number of incentives to plan and construct ethanol plants. This industry is being developed with massive subsidies, and there are those, particularly in animal agriculture, that are not at all happy with what it's done to their cost of production.
All right. Well, I think that we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sure we'll get back to some of these issues on another day, but for the moment, we stop with our thanks to Professor Robert Thompson. He holds the Gardner Chair in Agricultural Policy at the University of Illinois, former Director of Rural Development at the World Bank, one-time Dean of Agriculture at Purdue. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.